In this lecture, I'm gonna talk about more about the principle of, or the phenomenon of overfitting in these architectures. And before doing that, I'm gonna motivate the trade-off between bias and variance. So this is something that you'll encounter a lot in this field. So I'm gonna explain what this is. And then at the end of the lecture, I'm gonna talk about an example of supervised learning within the context of many-body physics, namely how we can use neural networks or feed-forward neural networks to learn the different phases of the Eisen model. So this is something you'll see also in the first homework that was posted today. Okay. So if everything is clear so far, let's get started with the bias-variance trade-off. So to explain what this is, let us assume that we're given some data sets. Again, it's the same setting. We have a bunch of inputs and a bunch of labels. And let's assume that we can decompose this data set into a bunch of, into two sub data sets, dn and dout. So what this means is that I'm considering dn as the bunch of data points and labels that are used to train the feed for a neural network, or any other neural network. Okay, so this is called the in sample data set. Or simply training data set. Okay, and D out, as you might have guessed, correspond to the samples that we have not used for the training. And this is also called the out of sample. Data set. Or sometimes you'll hear that this is called a testing data set. So this is the data set that you might want to use to test the generalization performance of your architecture on examples that were not seen in the training process. Okay. So now what we can get from these two data sets is two quantities, EN and E out. So what this EN means is the error that was made on each in the prediction on each label in this data set. So one way you could quantify this error is by summing the individual errors, similarly to what you have seen in the mean squared error cost function. Okay, so this is error. You can quantify this error in different ways. So one way you could do it is with using the mean squared error. So let me call this the error in the prediction that corresponds to this data, the in-sample data set. And similarly here, this is the error that you accumulate on the, this is the generalization error that you make on the out-of-sample data. Okay, so now one question that I wanted you to answer is, what would you expect, which one would be smaller, this one or this one? So what is the equality that you would expect based on the definition of these two quantities? Does anyone have a guess?
Error test in the testing data should be smaller.
So you're expecting that this is smaller than this one?
Because you've done gradient descent on DN.
Yeah.
Maybe we expect that to be smaller.
Exactly, yeah. So the rationale, as you mentioned, is that we're training on this data set. So the neural network have seen the data, so it's actually expected to do better. It's like when you're cramming for an exam. Like if you're like basically crammed for the material of your exam and if your exam is on something else, you expect that your grade is lower on that exam compared to on the material that you're actually crammed in, have not learned effectively. So this is one example. So this is like what we would expect. So E out should be bigger than E in, okay? So far, so good? Okay. So if we like plot both of these quantities in a graph where we're plotting on the y-axis the error on both en and eout, and on the x-axis we're plotting the number of data points. Assuming that we have the same number of data points, or like proportional number of data points, both in dn and dout. So okay, so assume that we're splitting, like let's assume for simplicity that we're splitting this d into half, okay, half into dn and half into dout. So what we would expect is that if we try to plot like the evolution of en as a function of the number of data points, so what would you expect? Okay, so let's just like assume that we're in the extremal cases. Okay, so this is like assuming that we have only one data point, and here let's assume that it's something that's very large. What would you expect the evolution from one data point, one training data point, to something that's very large, a million sample or a billion sample? Is it going to be up, going up or down?
Down.
So it's going to be up, down like this? Is that what you expect? So for instance, like if I'm giving you, like if you assume that you're, like there is a student who is trying to like revise for an exam, right? And like it's assumed that the student is only asked to memorize one page, okay? And let's also compare like the task of another student who's trying to memorize like a 50 page lecture notes. So who would you expect would do better if they're asked to kind of put out what they were memorizing? The first student or the second student?
When given one data point and one label, you can always find a function. Yeah.
So it's easier, right, exactly. So it's easier for the student who only got one page to memorize everything compared to the other student, given that they actually have the same like intelligence. So what we would expect is to have a very small error on one data point and a very large, relatively large error on that point. So we'd expect something that looks like that, okay? Is this intuition clear for everyone? Okay. So the analogy of a student here is the neural network trying to kind of fit those data points to those labels, okay? So the more data you have, the more difficult it becomes to get a lower error on the training data set or the in sample data points, okay? Yeah.
What's the E you're plotting? E, error?
Yeah, this is EN, okay. Yeah. So this is the error. So in red, I'm plotting EN. Now I'm going to ask you about the other part, which is E out. Okay, so
is that this theorem that we can approximate any sufficiently complicated function? Yeah.
Well, yeah. So this is like So part of it is related to this, but and also in real world applications, this is what you typically get, assuming that you get data points that are sampled from the same distribution. Like you get pictures of cats and dogs. If you get a new picture. Something like, yeah. So this is like, yeah, I don't have proof for this here, but this is the intuition that you get, that if you get a reasonable data set that's in the real world, you'll get something like this that saturates. Now, for the error that you're making on the out-of-sample distribution, so what would you expect? Do you expect to see the same behavior or the other behavior? So we know first that E out has to be something that's larger, so it should be somewhere here, okay? So we should not be somewhere, it should not be lower, okay? So what do you expect?
It should come down like this.
Exactly.
Converge onto the...
Exactly, so it should converge. So we, by intuition, like if we get like a lot of data points, this means that we would be able to generalize better. So at the optimal case, we expect that we get the in the limit over like large number of data points, we should expect that E out is about the same as the error that we're making on the in-sample distributions. But in that extreme example, like if we only learned about one example, it will be very hard to generalize to other cases. So in that case, we would expect to get a very bad generalization error. So we would expect to get something that's very, an error that's very large, okay? And should come down and saturate, as you can see over here, okay?
I'm a little curious. So what about the portion between the data, training data, and testing data?
So your question, can you say that again?
Out data, yeah. What was the is the portion fixed between the in data and out data?
Is the size fixed? Is that what you?
The portion between the size of the.
Yeah, so we're assuming that, for instance, the size of the n, just for simplicity, I'm going to tell you about another recipe for choosing, assuming that they're at least proportional to each other. Like it's not that this is like something fixed and this is increasing, okay? They're proportional to each other so that this argument holds, okay? Okay, are there any other questions so far? Okay, it's important that you kind of get this intuition because it's going to help you to understand the rest, okay? So if this is good, then, so what you see here in the asymptotic limit is describes what's called the bias. And what you see over here, this quantity over here is what describes what's called the variance. And you can see from this plot why there is a trade-off, because if you see here like that, when something is, when the variance is big, the bias is small, but when the bias is big, the variance is small. So there is some kind of dilemma. So ideally, what we want is to get a smaller bias and a smaller variance. So ideally, you want to get something like this. You want to have both En, Eout, and En very small. But that's not what we expect in real, like in world situations. You always have to kind of put you have to take best of both worlds. So you have to minimize variance as much as you can and also bias as much as you can so that you can get the best generalization possible to the out to the data that's outside the training distribution. Okay. So I'm gonna explain this a bit better by using another example. Okay, but before doing so, I just wanted to comment about what bias exactly means. So in that case, bias means you can quantify it as how powerful is your model to describe your training data set. And also, you could see variance as somehow how dependent your fit on your DN on the prediction that you make on the in the data points that are outside your training distribution. More specifically, how dependent is the fit on a specific realization of the training distribution? So what if you choose like another if you choose another data point, would you be able to generalize better? In that case, like, we have a very small size for the data in the training distribution, so we would expect a larger variance on the predictions. Okay. Is everything clear so far? Like, okay, good. So now let me explain what happens when we now change the complexity of the model or the expressiveness of the model instead of the number of data points. So if I now plot, so let me do it maybe in another. Maybe over there.
Mohammed?
Yeah.
How do you define the expressiveness of the model?
Well, yeah, so of course this is like something I'm gonna define it like intuitively, but of course there are ways you can rigorously measure the model complexity. I'm gonna just do it in a hand wavy way. One way you could you could see it intuitively is that if as you increase the number of layers, you'll get more expressivity. As you increase the number of neurons, you'll get also better expressivity. Or you could say it's like the ability for the model to handle like a complicated function. That's the hand wavy way of defining it. But of course, there are other ways you could define it more rigorously. That's not the scope of this lecture. If you want, we can talk about it after.
Okay.
That's a good question. Okay, so now let's see how would the error vary with the model complexity. So again, what I mean by model complexity could be like a number of neurons, hidden neurons, or the number of layers, anything that can make your neural network more complicated, or in other words, more expressive. Okay, so now if I want to plot the error that we're making on the in sample distribution or the training distribution, what would you expect the evolution of that error as a function of the model complexity? Okay. What do you expect?
Go down.
Yeah, exactly. So if we have like a very like a linear logistic regression model, you would expect that the error is somewhere over here, but you have a very deep neural network, you should expect that the error should be somewhere here. So it should be somewhere that goes down like this. Okay, so this is En, and it's En basically quantifies the bias. Okay, so the lower En, the lower the bias. Okay. And if we also increase the model complexity, then we should also expect that the model gets too complicated. So if the data is too simple, and if our model is too complicated, then we might the prediction that we could get could be something it's not expected. So I'm gonna explain why we have the variance increasing as the model complexity is increasing. Okay, so this is something that I will explain by using the demo that I'm going to show you in a second. And based on this trade-off that I have between the bias decreasing and the variance increasing, we should expect that the error that we're making on the testing distribution or out of sample distribution is something that decreases and then at some point reaches some sort of minimum. So that's the optimum. And then at some point it starts increasing. In that case, as we're making the model more complicated, our prediction doesn't get any better. So in that case, there should be some optimal set of hyperparameters, for instance, in a certain model, in particular, the feed-forward neural network, such that the prediction that we're making is the best possible within that context, okay? So, of course, this might seem like a bit like too abstract, but I'm gonna do an example so that you can connect to this picture over here, okay? Yeah.
Quick question. Yeah. It seems that the lowest point for the E out is before the crossing point, before the bias.
The reason why I try to avoid like this intersection with this intersection is that I haven't defined what variance means. Mm. Okay, so this like it has a clear statistical way of defining it. So since I haven't defined it, I actually like avoided this having like the intersection at the same time. So just so that you're not confusing this intersection with the optimum. Okay. So like all I want you to see here is that as this is going up and as this is going down, this should be some optimal. Similarly to what when you have like a function that's x, a power x to the n, and then an exponential, then you should see some optimum at some point. It's a similar case over here. Okay. So let me show you a demo using polynomials fitting so that you can relate to that point, to the idea of that plot over there. Okay. So I'm gonna.
Complexity doesn't mean sophisticatedness, right? It's really just the number of parameters.
Yeah, so this is what I meant by complexity, like how complicated your model is. Yeah.
Like if I would think about complexity, like I'm really smart in choosing my model, right? And
yeah. Like, so maybe I'll. maybe I'll change the word complexity, like let's say expressivity. Okay. Yeah. So maybe to be more like specific about this, although it's hard to define what this, I just wanted to highlight like a very intuitive idea that's very common in machine learning. So what I'm trying to show you here is how the prediction, the error that we're making on the out of distribution or out of sample data points depend on the degree of the polynomial. So here I'm fitting like a one dimensional, like a 1 degree polynomial, which is just a line on this distribution of data points. So as you see here, this is like something that's the degree one polynomial is something that's very simple, so it's not expressive enough to handle this curvature that we have over there. So this is called underfitting, okay? So whenever, this is something I wanna highlight over here. So in that case, going from here to the left, this is the case when you have underfitting. Okay, so this is illustrated by the degree one binomial, and from that side to the right, this is called overfitting that I'm gonna talk about later on. Okay, so let's see what do we mean by overfitting. So here I'm gonna, so I fitted like a degree 20 binomial, which is clearly something that's too complicated to fit that those data points. So as you can see, like that it clearly fits the data points that we have, but let's assume that we sampled another data points in the same distribution, and if it's somewhere close to these data points, our binomial will clearly give something, a prediction that's very far away. So the error will start on the out of sample data points will clearly increase, and this is what you would expect to see in that plot over there. As you increase the degree of that binomial, the E out will start to increase. But if we use something that's in the middle, like D equal to 3, which turns out to be the optimal degree for fitting, you'll see that this is what you will get, this minimum on D outs, okay? So this is only an example in binomials. You would expect to see the same thing happening for any neural network architecture or any model you use for doing machine learning, okay? So is this clear for everyone? Okay, yeah.
Question, so in this example, it seems there's some data points that's away from so-called ground truth.
Yeah.
So
this is like kind of like the, for sure you'll have some error that's intrinsic to the data. So this is like why you always get like an error that's non-zero. And this is because sometimes you have some noise in your data. Okay, if you're trying to make the model more expressive, then you actually do something that's out of contrary, like you're actually gonna increase the E out even more. Okay, so it's like the noise that we have in this data is actually not part of the physics of your data, or not part of what's going on in the real world. It's just some noise that got into the data. So
but this is different from the concept of EE, right? This like the variance of the bad data, that this variance is different from the concept of error in error.
Oh, so you mean here that EN is very small?
Yeah, I mean, is it EN is this, it seems for me that there are different concepts compared with this bad data. I mean, the error comes from the bad data.
So what I'm assuming that all the samples here that you see in red dots are actually the in data. And you can imagine some other data points that you can get from this similar distribution to these data points. So if they're distributed close to these data points, you would see that our like orange line, which is a model, will kind of be closer to these points. But if you use some more complicated fits, like this one, then if I choose a data point that's here, you can see that the prediction is very far away. So E out will start to increase very quickly. Okay, so this is kind of the balance that we have to take. Our model should not be too expressive and also not too simple. Okay, so this is the example I wanted to highlight here. Is that clear for you?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, sounds great.
That's really just because of the noise. Say you have noiseless data.
Yeah.
Want to like fit as much as possible, we can.
If we have a perfect data, that doesn't hold. But of course, there is always noise in real world data. So that's why we always have this trade off. Okay, that's a great point. And one last thing I want to show you is one interesting thing is what happens is that if I choose a very, very large degree, somehow when I do the fitting, it starts to become something that's actually more manageable. It's like it's the prediction, the E out starts to decrease. So this is something I want to briefly mention in case you're interested to learn more about. So at some point during the, as you increase the model complexity, you'll see that E out will start to decrease. And this phenomenon is called double descent. I'm not gonna talk about this very much. So it's a phenomenon that happens when you have a very, very large number of parameters. And the reason it's called double descent because you have the first descent and then the second descent, okay? So this is something that happens typically when you have a very, very large architecture. It's not gonna happen for at the scale of what we're going to experiment with. It only happens at the scale of very, very large neural networks in research, okay? So I just want you to be aware of these of this notion of double descent. Okay?
That's AI basically, right?
Is that
gonna work?
Yeah, so it's like, for example, it's ChatGPT could be a manifestation of this phenomenon. You have, as you get a very, very complicated model, you can see that the prediction gets even better. Okay, yeah.
Does the descent go below the first descent?
Yeah, that's something, yeah. If you want, like, I'm gonna post a reference about this. You can read more about it, yeah. That's a good question. Okay, so now we have talked about overfitting, which is the case that happens assuming that you haven't reached double descent yet. We want to kind of cure this overfitting in such a way that we bring this E out as small as possible. Okay, so this is what I'm going to talk about in the next part. But first of all, we need a way to diagnose overfitting, okay? So, of course, this E out is a way to do it, but I'm gonna use like a different like notation so that you can connect to this diagnosis in your applications, potentially in the homework, where you'll experiment with ways to diagnose overfitting. So, if you're training, if you plot the training costs as a function of the what's called epochs, or the number, basically that's the number of steps that you're making, typically one epoch. So if you have a large data set, and if you use many batch gradient descents, then going through the whole data set means one epoch. So in that sense, the number of gradient descent steps is not as the same as the number of epochs, but they're proportional to each other, okay? So this is just in case you've seen epochs, that means going through the whole data set at once in each step. So if you plot the training cost, which quantifies the error that we're making on the in-sample distribution, which is the training distribution, you should expect that it goes down. So this is something you'll see tomorrow in the tutorial. But now, if we use the training cost or training accuracy so as a way to quantify the accuracy that you're making on the training data points that are inside the DN dataset, you should expect that as we're going to very small errors, that we're saturating to something that's close to 100% accuracy. In the beginning, we should expect that we're making a very small accuracy in that it's going down as the training cost is going up, okay? So when you'll be making plots in the tutorial, you'll be able to see these kind of behaviors. And the same thing here as a function, or this spot is also as a function number of epochs. Okay, yeah.
I have a question about this in and out data.
Yeah.
So in the TensorFlow animation that you showed us, they show like training loss and
In Teslas.
Teslas, yes. Is it, does it do that? Does it randomly split the data?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So in that TensorFlow playground, you actually define the proportion of D out and the proportion of D in. And the training loss is corresponds to the error we're making here, and the test loss is corresponds to that
so you,
error.
So you define the proportion of them, and then it takes randomly.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. So this picture corresponds to the training data points. Now, to diagnose overfitting, we need to also define data points that are not seen by the neural network or outside of the training data, the training data. And this is what we have called there by the out of sample data sets. So in that case, and whenever we want to diagnose overfitting, we define three classes of data sets. So I'm gonna explain why. So we're gonna define the so-called training data. So that's exactly what we've seen by, this is what we call DN. And typically we take about 70% of the whole data set, okay? Now, this is the way we can quantify bias. Now, to quantify the variance, we need to define two data sets. The first one is called the validation data set, and also the testing data set. So both of these correspond to D out. But we're splitting them for a good reason that I'm going to explain in a second. So typically that's about 20% of the data. And that's typically taken as 10% of the whole data set. OK? Now, so those are just numbers that are like commonly used in the literature. You could use different numbers. Okay, so those are just recipes that are commonly used in the literature. And now the reason why we define two data sets from this out of sample data sets is for the following reason. So if we now plot the validation accuracy as a function of number of epochs. Of course, at some point you would expect to that it's going up. Okay. But as we reach that optimum, what do you expect? So if we reach that optimum on the E out, do you expect that it goes up or stays the same or goes down? What is your intuition? Yeah. Will go down, exactly, yeah. So either go down this way or this way. So it's not expected that it goes up, okay? So in that case, this is the optimum value for the accuracy. So in this case, we should stop training at that point.
Mohamed?
Yeah.
Again, I have a question about the TensorFlow
yeah.
animation. So E out would be the test loss, right?
Yeah. So test loss in the demonstration in the playground is actually both of these mixed together.
Yeah. So we saw examples where there was overfitting, yet the test loss was still going down.
Oh, in the demo?
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe I'm actually planning to show it again. Maybe once we go there, you can let me know.
Okay.
about what you have seen?
In practice, I mean, one idea that comes to mind is that you do this, like, how do I say, you increase your expressivity
yeah.
of your model, and then you check for the test error, and
yeah.
you see it, okay, at this point it's minimum, so let me take the parameters that I
yeah.
live with it, right? That's what you would do.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you're seeing that the test loss is going down, this is not overfitting. This is good. It means that the model is learning. In that case, this would correspond to like an accuracy that's still going up until it saturates to a very high accuracy.
I see. Maybe I'm wrong then. I thought that...
No, I can show you again, and then at that point, you could let me know. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Could you explain this again? I didn't understand.
This one? Yeah. So maybe I could explain it from the perspective of the... error that we're making on the validation data set. So this is eval is what I call the error that we're making on the validation data set. So what you would expect is something that's like this, right? So there is some optimum here. So in that case, we should stop the training here. If not from the perspective of the accuracy, that's the number of the ratio of data points that they predict correctly. And they're kind of inversely proportional to each other, accuracy and error. So if you have a shape like this, then you should expect to see a shape that's the inverse of that.
I can see why we have an optimum with model complexity, but why does that apply to this case when the x-axis is the e-pulse?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So as you're increasing, like as you're doing more gradient descent steps, you're giving the model the chance to learn better. It's effectively increasing the model complexity because you're trying to fit the training data more and more and more. And doing that, as for instance in the case of the polynomials with a very high degree, is not good. So you have to stop at some point. Okay. Does that answer your question? Yeah, a very good point. Yeah.
So expressivity isn't a constant for a particular training, right?
Yeah, so what I meant here by expressivity, assuming that you train it enough for a very large number of gradient descent steps, but it could also mean that as you increase in them, for a fixed model like expressivity, you could also see a similar plot, because the more you train, the better you're going to kind of fit the training data. For instance, in the example of the polynomials, if I run it for a few steps, it will do good. Like you'll see that the prediction is good. But if you train it for a very large number of steps, you'll see those kind of very irregularities in the plots for large degrees.
I agree, but my intuition is that that's not expressivity. That's just an artifact of like low.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I think these should be separate, but they kind of have the same effects. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Any other question? Okay. So now one question I didn't answer is, why do we choose a validation data set? So all I told you here is that this data set tells us about where we should stop. And that's actually why we need this testing data set, because this is, as we stop the training here, then this is where we're gonna make a prediction on the error that we're making on the testing data point, and also on the accuracy, on what's called the test accuracy. Okay. But you might ask me also like that, well, we could also report this accuracy that we're making here on the validation data points, on the validation data set, without using this testing data. But the reason why is that we don't want to fine-tune our hyperparameters in such a way that they are dependent on the validation data points. So we want to avoid overfitting also on this validation data set. So we want to make the prediction independently on the choice of the validation data set. Okay? So this is why we use another data set at the end of your hyperparameter tuning, so that at the end we only report this test accuracy and the error we're making. Typically, we use a test accuracy, but you could also see in other applications that they also report the test they're making on the error they're making on the test data set. Okay? Is this clear for everyone? Yeah.
So do you, while you're training it, so you find that where it's, the accuracy is optimum, and then you stop training your parameters?
Exactly, yeah. So you stop train, or you could save the parameters each time you train, and you could go back to the optimal parameters. But in other applications, you could see that it's saturated. So in that sense, it doesn't matter whether to stop. It's only when this goes down, this is where you should go back to where it was optimal. Okay, great point. Yeah.
Can you elaborate, when do we change the hyperparameter?
Over here or here?
Always there, yeah.
Here? Okay. Yeah. So you're asking like why would we?
When do we change the hyperparameter during the
training? Yeah, so this is typically when we use these data sets. So this is like when we vary hyperparameters. So this is something you'll have a chance to experiment with in the homework. So in that case, you could experiment with different number of layers, different number of neurons, and you could check what is the validation, what's the best validation accuracy. So the best validation accuracy that you get, this is like the one that you'll use to find the value of the test accuracy, which is expected to be smaller because of the same argument that I've highlighted between the in-sample and the out-of-sample distribution. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So now after we've seen how we can diagnose overfitting, which is over here, let's see how ways that we can cure overfitting within the training of neural networks. Maybe not here, where there. So now we're going to talk about the first method. It's called L1 or L2 regularization. So the idea is that you want to add some Lagrange multiplier to your cost function so that you can make your weights as small as possible. So for L1 regularization, you'll have your initial cost function. So this could be the mean squared error or the cross entropy that we've seen in the previous lectures, plus the L1, the sum of the L1 norm of all the weights that we've seen in the definition of the feed-forward neural network. And we're taking now the L1 norm, which is just the absolute value. So here, what I mean by the sum over weights is the sum over I and J, and also the number of layers, okay? And in front of this, before this sum, like we multiply by this lambda, which is a Lagrange multiplier, and it's called the deregularization hyperparameter. So it's something that's bigger than zero. It's called regularization. Regularization hyperparameter. We can do the same thing for the L2 norm. So we're going to have the same term, but now using the L2 norm, which basically means that we're going to take the square of the weights. Okay? So as you can see from the definitions, the fact that we are minimizing the initial cost function plus this term means that we also want the weights to be as small as possible with importance given to this factor dependent on the magnitude of this Lagrange multiplier lambda, okay? In the intuition that the reason why this regularization is effective at curing overfitting in some cases is because of that example of polynomials fit in. So if I have a bunch of data points, and if I want, if I'm fit in with some complicated polynomial, and then if I'm imposing this constraint on the weights or the coefficients next to the degree, next to the n factors, at the end you will expect to get something that would fit the data points better. And that's because you could see that from this example. For instance, if I take a polynomial p of x equal to the sum, well, let's call it lambda 4 x to the 4 plus lambda 3 x to the 3 plus lambda 2 x to the 2 plus lambda 1 x plus lambda 0. You could see that if these parameters, lambda 4 and lambda 3, are very big, then you would expect to see something that's complicated that oscillates. But if we kind of make these very small through this regularization, our model will become simpler, and this will allow us to get like a fit that's better. So in some sense, it's a way to decrease the model complexity, okay? So this is how you could see the L1. If you're using like a neural network that's too complicated, the regularization is an effective way of reducing the model complexity so that you're getting something that's simpler. And this, if you want to see it, like you could also take this example of polynomials, which also has the same like intuition. So now the idea behind like the choice of lambda is that if you choose lambda that's too large, you're putting too large so that this term is more dominant than this term, then you're putting more emphasis on minimizing this part, which means that you want your parameters to be, your weights to be very, very small. So in that case, for instance, all your parameters will be very small, so you will have only a line in particular, like only a horizontal line, which is clearly a signature of underfitting. So this is when you're reducing the model expressivity too much. So this is like the other end of that plot over there. Now, if lambda is too small, this means that this term is more dominant than the other term, then we'll put more emphasis on minimizing this cost function. So this is where you'll get overfitting. So you have to choose something in between, not too small and not too big. Okay. But before like showing you a demo for why this works effectively, let me show you another method for regularization, which is called dropouts. Maybe I could use that. Can I erase that blackboard? Okay. So assuming that you have some feedforward neural network, like this one, okay, so the idea is that you want to randomly select some neurons and remove them randomly, okay? So let's say that we choose with some probability of 1/2 to choose to remove one of the neurons. in the hidden layer. So at the end, we will get something that looks like that. So to only, for instance, those in the middle will be removed. So at the end, we will only have connections to those up and down. But in another like training step, we could also have like these, like for instance, on the top removed. So we only have connections with those. Okay. So the effect of this is that as you're doing more gradient steps, then this kind of like have an effect of self-averaging in such a way that you're reducing the variance on your predictions. And you could also see it as a way of like not, you could also see it as a way to do regularization in that example, because since the fact that we're moving like neurons stochastically, we're not putting too much weight on each neuron. It's like we're always like, the neural network in that case is trying to put like, to have like very small parameters connected to each neuron so that the predictions that you're making do not vary too much. And this is something I'm gonna show you at the end in the demo.
Well,
yeah.
For the job of this network, then what is the network that we're using for predict.
So what is the method that we're using to remove?
To predict the out data.
Yeah, so it's the same here. So here at the end, we have our prediction y hat. The same thing here, we have also prediction y hat.
So you predict every time average.
Yeah, so at the end, like it's kind of like a way of doing self-averaging, yeah. That's a good question. So, okay, so now let me go back to the playground that we have seen before in the previous lecture. So this is like a feed-forward neural network with an input layer, a hidden layer, and the output layer. And we have a bunch of inputs over here. We have X1, X2, and other features. And you can see that in that example, we have signatures of overfitting. You'll be able to see this in that plot, in that like demonstration over here. So you see here that the test loss is increasing while the training loss is decreasing, okay? And this is kind of also see, you can also see it from the decision boundary. It's something that's very complicated, okay? In that case, like you would expect that a line would be the best to separate between the two data sets. So clearly the model is not doing a good thing. And you could also see that the weights are very large, okay? So this is also not good. So a way to handle this is by using L2 regularization. So this is something you could tune and playground. So you could choose here L2, and then this number over here, 0.1, which is this lambda that I've shown you over here. So if we launch the training now, you could see that this nonlinear decision boundary changed from something that's simpler, which is a line over here. And you could also see from the thickness of the lines that the parameters are no smaller compared to what's before, okay? And something, another thing that's interesting about now the L1 regularization is that if you launch the training, you'll get somehow the similar effect, something that looks almost linear for the decision boundary. And the same thing here, the test loss and the training loss are almost the same, so that's good. But another interesting thing is that if you look at some of the weights, can you see that they are zero? Okay, so the interesting thing about L1 regularization is that it encourages weights to be closer to zero. And that's because if you look at the absolute value of X, Well, the gradients over here push the parameters to be closer to zero, and also the gradients over here pushes the parameters to be closer to zero. So it's like different from the L2 regularization where you have the gradients that looks like this has this other shape where the gradients do not encourage the weights to be closer to zero. So the L1 regularization is a way to encourage the model to be more sparse. It has less parameters. Okay, so that's another way of seeing the difference between L1 and L2 regularization. Okay. Now the final thing I want to show you is regarding the dropouts. Okay, so this is something you'll be able to see from this deeper playground. So I'm gonna post a link to that on the portal. So there is like a parameter called dropouts. So if I choose 50%, this means I'm gonna drop 50% of the neurons in the hidden layers. So here I'm not using any regularization, and when I'm gonna launch a training, you're gonna see that sometimes like some neurons appear and disappear. And effectively you'll see that if you average all these predictions, you'll get a line. And if I stop at some point randomly, you'll see that the prediction is much simpler. Like the decision boundary is almost linear compared to that one, which is very, very complicated. Okay. So if you want, you could also experiment with this further. I think we're a bit over time. So tomorrow I'll hopefully talk about the last point I didn't have a chance to mention regarding how we could use feedforward neural network to do classification of phases of matter. And then we also talk about, I'll provide a summary of the different hyperparameters we've seen so far for neural networks. And then I'll also talk about Monte Carlo sampling, which will be also helpful for the following lectures, okay? And just to note again, like the first homework is posted and the deadline is in 2 weeks from now. And if you have any questions, feel free to let me know, okay? Yeah, thanks very much.